It's the NPR News Update for Tuesday, January 7. Hi, I'm Phil Picardi with this podcast. Coming up, Minsure gets a checkup. Minneapolis has a new mayor and a city council, officially. It's been cold now for several days, and is there anything doctors can do about frostbite? First, the state's legislative auditor is launching an investigation into contracts the state signed with several vendors that helped build Minsure. That's the state's troubled new online health insurance marketplace. The auditor's investigation comes after a scathing letter from Governor Mark Dayton to one contractor in particular and months of complaints from consumers trying to use the site. Reporter Catherine Richard talked about it with Tom Cran.
What's the legislative auditor planning to do here?
Well, starting this week, he's going to investigate contractors Minsure hired to build this website, Minsure. Now, this investigation will include Maximus, which is the state's general contractor, but also IBM Curum. And this is a company we've been hearing a lot about. The state's agreed to pay them $3.9 million for software that's been the source of a lot of headaches for consumers.
Why is the auditor doing this investigation right now?
Well, two reasons. First of all, it is scheduled, and he's supposed to do it because the state is using federal dollars to pay for all of these vendors, and he's required to look at how that money's being spent. But Jim Nobles, who's the state's legislative auditor, also said he's really concerned about a letter Governor Mark Dayton wrote to IBM back in December. Now, this letter says the state was basically misled about IBM software and outlines 21 problems with the website that can be traced back to this IBM software. We've reported on those problems in the past. This includes people who are being told they don't qualify for subsidies to help buy insurance when they actually do, and people who have had pending applications for months now.
Catherine, usually when we hear about the legislative auditor, he's looking into what the state does and state processes. Is he going to look at that or at the contractors here?
Well, he's going to be looking at all of the above. You know, obviously, he's going to look at whether the vendors delivered on what they said they would do and whether the state was misled about those products. But I think it's even more significant that Nobles is going to look at whether the state properly managed these contracts in the first place and whether that's been a factor in all the problems that have cropped up. Now, Nobles and I spoke earlier today, and he said that the state shouldn't hire someone to do work and then be sort of a passive observer, especially in a big project like this. Minsure's been up for months, and he wants to know why the state has been so slow and late to understand what's going on.
What kind of time frame are we talking about with this investigation?
Well, Nobles said it's going to take at least a few weeks, but probably more months. And he said that he's anticipating a situation where his office starts to dig in and find other things that they want to investigate. So it could go on for a while.
Now, have you heard from Minsure or IBM today in relation to all this?
Well, Minsure never got back to us with comment, but IBM did. And they said that they have fixed a lot of these problems. And they also said that they're only one of several subcontractors on the project. You're not the only ones to blame here. And finally, they added that senior IBM officials have made fixing these issues a top priority and that they're in regular contact with Governor Mark Dayton. But in the meantime, we're still hearing from people on social media and people who are contacting us directly saying they still have applications pending, they're locked out of their applications, they're confused whether they're covered, and these are people who needed coverage on January 1st.
Catherine Richard, thank you, as always.
No problem.
And that's All Things Considered host Tom Cran. Officials with the Diocese of New Ulm want to keep secret a list of priests credibly accused of sexual abuse. Elizabeth Baer reports.
Lawyers for a victim of clergy sexual abuse want a Brown County court judge to order the diocese to release the list, which contains the names of priests who have credible allegations of sexual abuse. Diocese officials declined to comment, but in a statement said two of the people named in the list believe the sexual abuse allegations made against them are false, and their names should therefore not be made public. The New Ulm Diocese is the only one in the state that has not released names of accused priests, either voluntarily or by court order. Church officials have made similar disclosures at the Archdiocese of St. Paul in Minneapolis, as well as St. John's Abbey and the dioceses of Winona, Duluth, St. Cloud, and Crookston. A ruling in New Ulm is expected later this week. Elizabeth Baer, Minnesota Public Radio News, Rochester.
A district judge has ruled a program offering drivers a class and reduced fine in lieu of a traffic ticket is not allowed under state law. The 10-year-old program was the subject of a lawsuit filed by residents and two county commissioners back in August. Wabasha County Sheriff Rodney Bartsch says he will end the program immediately.
We had a lot of county attorneys across state siding with us, and we could probably appeal this, but I don't think we're likely going to do it at this time, but it's just a terrible loss for the citizens of our county and for those across the state that are going to lose this program.
None of the proceeds from Wabasha's safe driving program were shared with the state. The attorney who filed the lawsuit accused the county of being motivated by economic gain. There are 35 other similar programs operating in Minnesota. They won't be directly affected by Monday's ruling, although the decision leaves them open to legal challenges. The first of two public meetings on upcoming reports on the Southwest Light Rail Line is tonight. Laura Ewan reports.
The Metropolitan Council says the purpose of the meetings is for elected officials to gather input on three studies now underway. One study will focus on freight rail relocation options needed to make way for the LRT system. Residents of Minneapolis and St. Louis Park have argued over whether to divert the freight trains to the First Ring suburb or keep them in the park-like Kenilworth corridor of Minneapolis. Another study will focus on how the project would affect lake levels and water quality within Kenilworth. The third study will inventory existing trees and scope out opportunities for replanting. Drafts of the reports are expected to be released later this month. Planning for the controversial project has been held up since October when Governor Mark Dayton postponed a long-awaited Met Council vote on the freight route. Laura Ewan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis predicts Minnesota's economy will grow moderately this year. Here's Martin Moylan.
The bank's outlook includes more of the sluggish rebound of the past few years. Rob Grunewald is an economist with the bank.
Forecast models point to moderate employment growth and a decrease in the unemployment rate. The Business Outlook Survey shows that optimism is at a seven-year high. Manufacturers expect growth, while the home building recovery is expected to continue into 2014.
Employment is expected to grow by 1.2%, which would likely be the slowest pace since 2010. The jobless rate drops a bit in the forecast to 4.3% by the fourth quarter of this year. The bank's survey of businesses found optimism about the state's economy was the greatest it's been since 2007, with 72% feeling bullish. Businesses said they expect it'll be harder to find qualified workers, but indicated they only plan to offer modest wage increases of 3% or less. Martin Moylan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Racial equality is on the agenda at the Minneapolis City Hall. It was a recurring theme as the city swore in a diverse new city council yesterday. It was a common thread through the speeches, the protests, and it was even an undercurrent in the election of council leadership. Curtis Gilbert reports.
The white residents of Minneapolis are doing much better than its minority communities. Disparities persist in areas including education, employment, even health. And while those gaps exist throughout the country, they're worse in the Twin Cities than just about anywhere else. At today's council inauguration, Mayor Betsy Hodges vowed to close those gaps. She says she even talked to President Obama about it when she met with him last month.
I told him that it must be possible for white people and people of color to all thrive in one city and in one region, and that we in Minneapolis, we would be the ones to do it. And I told the President of the United States that my goal for Minneapolis is just that, to get that right.
Hodges didn't outline specific policy proposals for achieving that goal. She promised those would come later. But she did paint a picture of a future where North, Northeast, and Central Minneapolis experience accelerating growth.
The population is growing at a faster clip than the rest of the city, and they are adding jobs and businesses faster than the rest of the city. Arts, commerce, and housing make these neighborhoods destinations in their own right. And modern rail, LRT, and streetcars spur this growth as they make their way through the streets and through our neighborhoods.
Equity now! Equity now!
Activists from Neighborhoods Organizing for Change and Occupy Homes gathered in the City Hall Rotunda after the ceremony. It wasn't exactly a protest. Organizer Anthony Newby praised Hodges' speech and the diversity of the new council, which includes members of the Somali, Hmong, and Latino communities. But Newby vowed to hold the politicians to their promises.
We know they want to support these issues. Many of them ran on these issues of equity. We expect from day one that they'll prioritize these issues of equity.
The demonstration was initially organized in support of Elizabeth Glidden's bid to become president of the Minneapolis City Council. Some newly elected council members thought changing council leadership would give the racial equity issue more momentum. But Glidden failed to muster the votes to unseat Barbara Johnson, who's led the council for the last 8 years. Johnson says she shares the goal of reducing racial disparities.
You know, I represent part of North Minneapolis where those racial equity gaps are the most stunning. And I think we really have to look at the concentration of poverty in our city. We have over-concentration, in my opinion, in North Minneapolis of subsidized housing, and I think it's creating problems within our city.
Johnson won the council presidency in a unanimous vote. Glidden was elected vice president. She says she's happy the council is focusing on racial equality.
I think that we have a community that is anxious for us to make measurable progress, and we have a responsibility to respond to that urgency.
It was a mostly harmonious first day for the new council. The only divided vote was over whether to give the protesters time to speak at the meeting, a departure from normal council procedures. Alondra Cano, one of seven new members on the council, wanted to give them the floor for 15 minutes.
I realize that this may be not a very typical move, and I think that through untypical moves, government can become more responsible and connected to the community members that we seek to represent.
Opponents argued turning the meeting into a public hearing would set a bad precedent, and the measure failed. Both Johnson and Glidden voted not to let the protesters speak. But in a sign of their shared goals, Mayor Hodges joined the activists in song under the City Hall rotunda. Curtis Gilbert, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
It's the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Minnesotans awoke to another day of cold weather, though the polar vortex we've been hearing so much about is actually sliding off to the east today. In the Twin Cities, it might make zero this afternoon before climbing back to near normal by Thursday. Still, many schools across the state are closed today. Matt Sepik ventured into the coldest weather in a decade.
Even if you're not into pond hockey, hot dish, or the state fair, you can still stake a claim on a piece of Minnesota culture if you step outside on a morning when it's minus 18 with a minus 27 wind chill. Many Twin Cities residents declined that opportunity yesterday. Except for a few cars plying the icy road, Lake Harriet in South Minneapolis was as quiet as a lake deep in the North Woods. Even in the winter, the Minneapolis chain of lakes trails draw plenty of cyclists and joggers. But yesterday, runner Danielle Ingram had the trail pretty much to herself.
Because it's so cold, that's why I'm out here, if that makes any sense. If it's going to be this cold, I got to get something out of it. I don't think it makes a lot of sense. I don't recommend it, but partially it's bragging rights.
Just down the trail, riding a mountain bike with knobby tires was Parker Rowan Fans.
I'm just heading into the office.
The cold weather didn't keep him from his daily 8-mile two-wheel commute from Lake Nokomis to St. Louis Park.
Well, you can't ride every day of the year if you don't ride today. So that's kind of my go-to attitude. A few buddies of mine went out for a ride last night and grabbed a few beers and decided that last night it wasn't too bad.
If a quiet bike ride around a frozen lake isn't your thing, there's always indoor dodgeball on a trampoline. With schools and parks closed, dozens of kids and their parents descended on Sky Zone in Plymouth. Children and some adults bounced around on wall-to-wall trampolines. Among them, 9-year-old Truman Philbrandt and his sister Claire, who's 7.
I did the foam pit a few times, but mostly I just stayed on the main court.
I mostly jumped. I jumped once in the foam pit.
Dad Steve Philbrandt hit the trampolines too and says it was a good way to beat cabin fever.
I figured we could all use a little exercise, get out and get our wiggles out.
While some use the cold weather as an excuse to do something fun and different, for others, sub-zero temperatures made a difficult situation even worse. Jerry Lauer is director of the Dorothy Day Center, a homeless shelter in St. Paul run by Catholic Charities. Lauer says because the cold snap happened at the beginning of the month, when many people received public assistance and retirement checks, the shelter wasn't as busy as it might have been. Still, Lauer says all the time indoors is taking its toll on people.
Part of what helps you get through the day sometimes is that movement, the fresh air, getting outside, kind of getting and doing what you need to do. And with this cold weather, it's a very tough situation. And by the end of a 3 to 4 day stint, it really makes it tough for folks to keep it together.
Frostbite and hypothermia have been troublesome too. At Regents Hospital in St. Paul, spokeswoman Kristen Kaufman says the emergency room and burn center have seen 8 cases of hypothermia and 14 frostbite cases. Kaufman says all 8 of the intensive care beds in Regents Burn Center are occupied by patients suffering frostbite injuries.
While the numbers of frostbite patients may seem pretty low given the extreme cold, a lot of the cases that we have been seeing are severe enough to require inpatient treatment. In fact, one of our physicians has said that we've received a record-breaking number of extreme frostbite cases coming into Regents. It's the most he's ever seen.
The state health department learned a hard lesson about the expansive properties of frozen water. The agency says it's suspending testing in its infectious disease and environmental labs after a building heating system quit and some pipes froze and leaked. The damage is estimated at $1 million. While it's still going to be cold today, temperatures are slowly creeping back up. And in a sign that things are getting back to normal, the Minneapolis Park Board says all indoor and outdoor programs will resume today.
Matt Sepik there on the NPR News Update. It's been dangerous outside for a reason. When wind chills dip into the 30s below zero, it can take less than 10 minutes for frostbite to set in on exposed skin. Extreme cases of frostbite can result in amputation. Kathy Werzer talked with William Moore about frostbite. He is co-medical director of the Burn Center at Regents Hospital in St. Paul.
I understand your staff was pretty busy with as many as 14 people coming in for treatment. And judging from a pretty graphic photo in the Pioneer Press, these look like pretty serious cases.
They are. This is the most patients that we've had in any one 24-hour period, and probably the most sustained stretch of severe frostbite injuries that we've had.
What's your definition of severe frostbite?
Severe frostbite would be that which threatens body part, fingers, toes, hands, feet. These are areas that cause intense blistering after they're rewarmed, and it's actually caused by the arteries feeding those areas. They get plugged up with debris from the damaged cells from freezing.
Looks like these extremities can get pretty swollen.
They can. That's part of the reperfusion. Once blood flow starts coming back, those cells that haven't had any blood flow or any oxygen will really swell, and that's part of the damage process.
Is that what happens when frostbite sets in, that the cells just shut down?
Right. It first starts by the arteries going out to the extremities start squeezing down to control the core temperature for the trunk and the brain. After a while, the body essentially gives up on doing that and just clamps down and doesn't let any blood flow to the extremities. And then the extremities rapidly cool and ice crystals actually form in the tissue. And then when they rewarm, damage to the cells occur from damage from the ice crystals and also from the lack of oxygen for a prolonged period of time.
Is it pretty obvious when frostbite is setting in, or can it sneak up on you?
You know, at these temperatures, it can really sneak up on you. We've had people just with a hole in their glove or wet protective clothing that have felt cold, and then it felt better, mostly because it went numb. But that's not a good sign in this kind of temperature. So it can sneak up on you.
Is there anything that you can do now to treat frostbite that you couldn't do a few years ago if someone actually gets into the hospital?
The first damage is just from no blood flow to the area and the ice crystals in the tissue. Then after you get them rewarmed, you get a second injury where the inside lining of the arteries are very sensitive to cold injury. So they slough off, travel downstream, and then plug up the arteries to the hands, feet, toes, fingers. And there is a treatment. It's thrombolytic therapy, clot-busting medication, similar to what they do when you have a clogged artery in your heart or a blocked blood vessel from a stroke in your brain. special catheter and deliver clot-busting medication and try and dissolve those clots to reestablish the blood flow again.
In your experience, what populations are most vulnerable to frostbite like this?
Well, certainly the homeless. Unfortunately, alcohol plays a big role. But also there's the people who didn't quite plan ahead. Those dressed appropriately for indoors, but when their car stalls or runs out of gas or runs into the ditch, you know, their tennis shoes just aren't going to protect them as they try and walk for help.
Dr. William Moore is with Regents Hospital. He was there with Kathy Werzer this morning on Morning Edition. I'm Phil Picardi, glad to have you along on the NPR News Update. Come back tomorrow for Minnesota's news on a Wednesday.